Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren and this is our internet talk radio program recorded from the west coast of Sverige. And we are here every Thursday and Sunday with a new program available through our website redicecreations.com. Today we have with us Dr. Anne Blake Tracy. She holds a PhD in health science with the emphasis on psychology and serves as the executive director of the International Coalition for Drug Awareness. And she has specialized for 17 years in adverse reactions to serotonergic medications such as Prozac, Seraphim, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox, Celexa, Lexapro, to name just a few, as well as painkillers, and have testified before the FDA and congressional subcommittee members on antidepressants. And since 1992, she has testified as an expert witness in Prozac and other SSRI-related court cases around the world. Some of the more high-profile cases she has worked on would be the murder-suicide of comedian Phil Hartman and his wife Brynn, the Columbine and Red Lake school shootings, Andrea Yates, the Texas mother who drowned her five children, the Atlanta day trader, Princess Di's death, the murder-suicide of the royal family of Nepal, Anna Nicole Smith's son, Daniel's death. Her latest book on the Prozac family of antidepressants, Prozac, Panacea or Pandora, or Serotonin Nightmare, is the product of many, many years intensive research and the cases of approximately 1,000 patients on a long-term basis. The websites that you should take a look at right away is drugawareness.org, and also take a look at ssristories.com for much more information on Anne Blake Tracy and also, of course, of her organization, International Coalition for Drug Awareness. Welcome to the program, Dr. Anne Blake Tracy. It's great to have you, and thank you for coming on with the busy schedule I know that you have.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. I want to help bring some focus to this issue of antidepressants, or SSRIs, and help inform anyone out there who are either considering taking antidepressants or currently is taking them, or to any existing or future parents that have their kids on antidepressants. And I thought that we could begin, you know, with the basics here today, Anne. First of all, the most basic stuff. What are antidepressants or SSRIs?
Well, the SSRI antidepressants, actually all of them work the same way, but this is just a new way of marketing antidepressants and calling them SSRIs. It stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor, meaning that the drugs go in and impair your ability to metabolize the neurotransmitter serotonin so that it will start to build up in the brain. Because the whole hypothesis behind these drugs is that when you're depressed, your serotonin levels are low.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're trying to do is build those serotonin levels up. The problem is, according to research over the last three decades, serotonin is not low in depression. It's actually high.
Hmm.
What is low is your ability to metabolize, which is exactly what these drugs impair.
Mm-hmm.
So, in effect, they are actually making the problem worse. You may get an initial high from the shock to the system, but that's all you're going to get. Is an initial high. And anybody knows that what goes up comes down.
Oh, yeah.
And many people, I just heard from someone last night who was trying to get off of these, which is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very upset. He said, I've never been depressed in my life, but now I'm depressed and suicidal. And he said, I didn't go on these for that.
Yeah.
How did this happen? Well, it happened because that's what these drugs actually cause in the long run.
Hmm. So this is the basic of this is that this changes the chemistry of the brain. Is that correct?
Yes, it does. I tell people that actually what's really happening with these drugs is that they're literally constipating the brain. They're keeping the brain from eliminating what they are supposed to eliminate. When serotonin metabolizes, it breaks down into other substances like melatonin that helps you to sleep, which is why patients on these drugs can't sleep. But it just, we're messing with things that we know nothing about. I know science is very good at making us believe that they know so much. But unfortunately, that is not true.
I mean, what is the science behind this? How can how can we come to this conclusion, or they rather than when you say that they actually have the opposite effect to what they're supposed to have?
Very good question. The nickname for serotonin is 5-HT, and the nickname for serotonin metabolism is 5-HIAA. And what they were beginning to think is that when 5-HT went up, the 5-HIAA would also go up. But when you look closely at all the research and really read it, it's the exact opposite. And the biggest problem in science today is scientists do not read research. They just don't. I mean, find me a doctor that even bothers to read a package insert on one of these drugs.
Is that so?
It's extremely rare. I think there's probably more patients that read them than doctors do. I really do.
Really, really.
Anyway, that's the way it is in America.
Sure, sure. So, this must then be some kind of... someone came up with this idea at the beginning, and now all the pharmaceutical companies have been pumping out these. I mean, there's a slurry, I guess, of different names or different brands out there on the market.
Exactly.
Maybe we can mention a few of these so people know what we're talking about here.
Sure. There's Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil. These are called different names in different countries, too.
Sure.
And then we have Celexa, Lexapro, Effexor, Remeron, Cerazone. There are so many of them. The new Cymbalta by Lilly to replace Prozac when it ran out of its patent. And Cymbalta is the one where they gave it to healthy volunteers and one of them hung themselves in their laboratory.
Oh, really?
I don't know how they got that on the market, but they did. And I pulled off an article last night where they were telling everyone that it's just wonderful for... people who have problems with urinary incontinence. They're getting them to take it for that as well. But then these drugs have been prescribed for decades to children that wet their beds at night.
Oh, really? Is that it?
Yes. This is terrible. I had one boy get hold of me from England. He's now in his 20s. And he said it was just terrible. He grew up on these drugs because of a problem with bedwetting, thinking he was insane.
Really?
Because of the effects of the drug and having no idea that it was coming from his medication at all.
Yeah.
I mean, who would stop and think that it's your bedwetting medication
making
you crazy?
Yeah.
But these drugs are so similar in action to drugs that we've seen in the past. Ecstasy, LSD, PCP, these are all serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Exactly. I read that on your website, drugawareness.org, and it said that the brain chemical these drugs increase, serotonin, is the same brain chemical that LSD, just as you said, LSD, PCP, and other psychedelic drugs mimic in order to produce their hallucinogenic effects. So, I mean, what the heck is going on here? Is this a mild form of hallucinogenic drug, then?
That's right. In fact, the National Institute of Mental Health here in America just 2 weeks ago released a new study, and I thought that their spin on this study was really interesting. What they did is they said, oh, we've tested a drug called ketamine for depression. Now, ketamine is known as Special K in the street.
Mm-hmm.
It is a street drug. It is a drug that is not allowed to be used in humans generally. It is a sister drug to PCP, angel dust.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got one whole chapter in my book that was written clear back in 1994 that shows the striking similarities between PCP and these new antidepressants. I was just shocked to see how similar that they were.
Oh my God, yeah.
And they came out in this study and they actually said that these drugs have the same effect. It's just that antidepressants take a little bit longer to produce that effect. And they found that ketamine would get rid of depression within minutes or hours, mm-hmm. where antidepressants will take weeks. And they were saying, this is wonderful. If we can come up with a new drug that will do this without causing all the hallucinations that these cause, then we'll be doing great. And I'm standing back going, now wait a minute, everyone. They just told you. An antidepressant will do the same thing as this drug, will have the same effect. It just takes a few weeks as opposed to minutes or hours. Now, what you need to understand is that PCP was introduced as a medication. It was introduced as an anesthetic, mm-hmm. which is what ketamine is as well. So they're literally anesthetizing patients with these drugs. And I've put brainwave patterns of a patient on Prozac in my book. And the brainwaves show this patient after 6 months on the drug in a total anesthetic sleep state and dreaming while he's sitting there talking to the people doing the test on him.
Really? Oh, my God.
And that's literally what they've just admitted through the National Institute of Mental Health here in America.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and my God. I am just appalled that they think we're stupid enough that we're going to say, oh, yes, isn't this wonderful, but that's all our media is doing here.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yes, isn't this wonderful? Now we can produce this effect faster.
So is this something that builds up in the system then, and kind of because
yes,
if
because
this,
it's the serotonin that's producing that effect. So as serotonin builds up higher and higher, there's more and more of the anesthetic effect. But the drugs also accumulate in the system. They accumulate in brain tissue at very high levels. They're protein binding, and they bind to tissue.
So, I mean, I read on the Wikipedia thread, basically under, I think it was under SSRI, or actually, no, wait a minute, this was actually under HDHD, the symptom, and they talked about depression in there. And they said that they thought that depression is thought to be caused by a lack of information flow between neurons, and of course this is what these SSRI drugs then are supposed to help, I guess. But but the question then is, of course, if you start taking these kinds of drugs in order to help the brain to pass, to keep the information flow between neurons, doesn't that mean that also that the natural processes eventually for this flow actually shuts off? So if you try to go off these drugs, this will totally shut down?
We do know that there is a terrible turmoil within the brain, whether you're starting on these drugs or coming off of these drugs. the FDA, when they issued the black box warning on these drugs for children, they also issued a warning saying that if you abruptly change your dose of an antidepressant, and that's going up or down on the dose, so starting the drug or stopping the drug or even adjusting the level of the dose that you're taking while you're on it, can cause suicide, hostility, which is often their term for homicide, or psychosis, generally a manic psychosis, which is why here in America, every third person you meet now is bipolar. It's because they've all taken an antidepressant and they've abruptly gone on the drug, which means they've taken a whole pill instead of just shaving a little tiny bit and slowly building up, which is what they'd have to do it safely. We went through this with steroids, and it took us so long to learn with steroids that this was the problem as well. Now doctors will not give steroids unless they take a patient up very, very slowly, keep them on a short time, and take them down very, very slowly. And these drugs are no different. One single 30-milligram dose of Prozac will double the body's version of cortisone, a steroid. It has a strong steroid effect. So we're getting that same effect, and they've got to learn that if they're ever going to prescribe these and use them in any kind of safe manner, which I really don't think is possible. But the only way they could ever possibly do it is to take a patient up very, very gradually and bring them down very gradually. And they'd have to be watched constantly. PCP was given in a hospital setting. And because of that, it only stayed on the market 7 years. It wasn't even used a full 7 years, and then the company decided on their own to pull the drug because it was found to be so dangerous. Any law enforcement officer anywhere in the world never wants to run into anyone on PCP, angel dust. It's so deadly. People just go completely crazy. They don't know what they're doing. They're literally sleepwalking and acting out what they're dreaming.
Oh, my God.
And generally, the serotonin is producing nightmares. So what they're doing is reacting to a nightmare that they're having. Which is exactly what these drugs do. That's called a REM sleep behavior disorder. And that disorder, we already know, 86% of the patients being diagnosed with that are on an antidepressant.
So does
where
this...
before we only knew it as a drug withdrawal state. That's about the only time we ever saw it. Now 86% of the patients are on it.
So
when they come off, watch out. That's why you've got to be very careful coming down off of these and come very, very slowly and gradually.
So
very slowly.
When you say that this upset the, some of the sleep patterns and you connect it with nightmares, so, so this is like because people aren't, they can't, you know, process this, you know, information or whatever you want to call it through their nightmares or through their regular dreams. This is something that kind of comes into your regular life or you know, normal awaking life, as it were, and the two world becomes blurred almost?
If you cannot go into a dream while you are asleep, that is so critical for brain function that you will go, the brain will force you into a dream while you're awake. Rusty Yates will tell you in a heartbeat that what his wife, Andrea, did when she drowned all five of their children was acted out her very worst nightmare. She was an incredible mother. She gave up her nursing career to spend all of her time with her children. In fact, Andrea was the third nurse in a row in a 3-month period here in America to go to court for killing her children while on these drugs.
Hmm.
The other two were both married to doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Nurses married to doctors. I've got so many doctors and nurses going through this. It's unbelievable. While Andrea's case was in court, there was a woman doctor that stabbed her two sons on the same drug that Andrea was taking, Effexor. Now, Effexor has homicidal ideation listed now as a side effect.
Oh, really?
They added that almost 2 years ago.
Huh.
And yet the company admitted that they had this information before they ever put the drug on the market. So they knew before Andrea Yates ever took the first pill that she could possibly do what she did to her children, and they did not warn. Do I think she, as a nurse, ever would have taken that drug had they warned of that? No.
Of course not. So, okay, this takes us, you know, into... You know, the obvious avenue of okay, why, what the heck is going on, and so forth. But just before we go there, I just want to mention that then that this seems to be an attempt, maybe then by the drug companies or whatever, you know, marketed through the lobbyists or whatever, to legalize a version that is very similar to the drugs that are illegal, that are available on the streets.
Right. Well, and all the drugs that are illegal used to be legal.
Yeah.
Well, that's where we got all of our illegal drugs, or the large majority of them.
That's right.
LSD
that's right.
was put out by the makers of Prozac.
Is that so? Really?
Yes. It was initially put out by Sandoz in Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
And Sandoz said, hey, we got this great new drug. It'll help us understand how people go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you take it, you go insane. And so, of course, nobody wanted to volunteer to be a test subject for that drug. So what actually happened was the CIA here in America decided that they thought LSD was wonderful for a mind control drug.
Of course.
So they sent two agents with a brown paper bag that contained 80% of their initial budget. And they sent them over to Switzerland to buy up all the LSD that Sandoz had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they got there, they found out that Sandoz had only an ounce or two. Because they were growing theirs naturally. They came back to the United States, went straight to Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, and said, listen, we want to use this drug for mind control in order, you know, for public safety and all that.
Sure.
Yeah, anything for an excuse.
Of course.
Sheesh. And we need it in a synthetic form. Can you get us a synthetic LSD? And they said, sure, we'll deliver it by the truckload. And they did. And when they, just before they got their patent, there was a big article that came out in Life magazine stating that this new miracle drug that was coming out was going to cure mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And cure alcoholism and aid in psychoanalysis. Complete turnaround from what Sandoz had said about LSD.
Yeah.
And they began to learn that if they just lie through their teeth about their drugs, they can sell them. And they can become very, very wealthy doing it. And they have. They bring in $200 million a day just on antidepressants alone.
Really? Oh, my God.
It is just unbelievable how much money they're making. What incentive is there for them to tell the truth about their drugs? Or to say, oops, we made a mistake, like they did with PCP?
But
I mean, early on we had studies showing that these drugs would produce LSD flashbacks.
So, I mean, let's see here. I'm very glad that you took that avenue and connected it with mind control, because this was one aspect that I did want to get into, and especially when when I read that on your website that this had very similar effects to LSD as it builds up in the system and so forth.
Right.
So, I mean, what's going on here? Is this some kind of mass mind control program going on here? I mean, I know that there were...
Well, I'll tell you, even I've started to wonder.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done this for 20 years. When I first started, I thought it would take a year, maybe two at the most, for people to see the problem with the hypothesis behind these drugs. And that everyone would say, uh-oh, we really made a mistake. Let's turn around here and do it the right way. There's no way you could have convinced me then that now I would still be trying to educate people about what these drugs are doing.
Yeah.
But I didn't know I was fighting that much money. I had no clue.
And this seems to have been going on for a long time. People like... Albert Hoffman and Al Hubbard were, instrumental in spreading LSD on college campuses back in the 60s, and as another means to get this drug out there. Back then, it seems to be more, covertly done. I don't know if that's the right word, but today it comes to us through this package of the men in white, as it were, through the doctors.
Oh, I know. I know, it amazes me. I mean, when I lived in Germany for a short time, I visited Dachau. And that was such a horrible experience for me. I walked in, I looked at just a few of the pictures hanging on the wall of what they did to people. And I just turned around and ran. I couldn't get out of there fast enough. It was so clear the minute you walk in there that it was used for medical experimentation. And yet we advertised those on the radio, on television, in the newspaper. Come in, take our drugs, we'll pay you. Just going, oh. It's like we've got Dachau on every corner.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
People volunteer to do it, and they get paid for doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Sheesh,
it just amazes me, and then they just go through hell. My own niece attempted suicide on these drugs just a few months ago, even in spite of all that I do.
Yeah.
They got to her, talked her into taking them when she went away to college. And we almost lost her.
But it's I mean, it comes to us in a package of, as you said, this is about, if we talked about the kids here, especially, school children and so forth, it comes to us in this package that this is to help the children, and this is to, being able to give all the kids the same benefits to be able to learn at the same rate or whatever. I mean, we have again, massive amounts of different kind of names for, it seems to be almost like new diseases popping up. As I mentioned, we have ADHD, we have ODD, this is, of course, oppositional defiance disorder and stuff like this.
What would they do without initials?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, I say it's all CRAP.
What's that?
Crap.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah. CRAP, yeah.
But
I mean, what's happening here? I mean, are the kids sick? Is this modern diseases? What's wrong here?
It comes from the fact that nobody paid any attention to history. If you read history, you find that there were sugar wars that were no different than the cocaine wars that we see. Sugar is almost identical in action to cocaine. And yet we use it, we refer to it as a food. In America, we consume amazing amounts of the stuff. Kids get up in the morning instead of breakfast. You know, they grab a candy bar and a pop and head off to school. And their blood sugar's already low before they do that because it goes the lowest overnight. You stick that in your system first thing in the morning, and your blood sugar drops, and what does your body do? It kicks in adrenaline to normalize the sugar level. And you've got a hyperactive kid. And then we go, wonder where that came from. Now, if you gave him cocaine every morning, you wouldn't be surprised to see him act that way.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
But we just, it tastes good, you know, so who cares, right?
But, you know, we got
to learn the science behind what we're doing wrong.
But
you can give them an apple. You can go to the health store and get something natural that's made with fruit and nuts that tastes just as good as any candy bar. And we've just got to learn to be more responsible in our health, and we're not. I don't know about other countries, but I know in America, hypoglycemia is absolutely rampant because of our high consumption of sugar for so many generations. And we just really need to learn. As far as I'm concerned, hypoglycemia is like the worst disease out there. I've had cancer. I would take cancer over hypoglycemia any day. Because with hypoglycemia, your blood sugar drops, and then you can't think to know what to do for yourself. You lose brain cells immediately when the blood sugar drops.
Really?
Immediately, you begin, the brain cells begin to die. So it will produce brain damage faster than anything that we know of. And these drugs are notorious for dropping the sugar levels. In fact, that's the first thing that I saw with it. I was in Utah at that time, living there, surrounded by people of the Latter-day Saint faith called Mormons. That part of their religion is they do not drink alcohol. Well, you gave them one of these drugs, and they were alcoholic almost overnight, although they'd never even tasted alcohol in their life.
Really?
They were having these overwhelming cravings to drink. Well, I knew immediately it had to be affecting the blood sugar, so I went to the pharmacy and asked for a package insert and read it. Sure enough, there was both hypoglycemia and diabetes reported as side effects. And I said, well, no wonder we're seeing this. It's affecting the pancreas so negatively that it's throwing them into severe blood sugar drops, which was probably the initial problem, because when the sugar levels drop, one of the first things you see is depression.
Really?
Because you're losing brain cells. The body's trying to say, hey, help. Your brain's dying. Do something quick.
Oh, my God. But now, you know, they have this new wonderful stuff called aspartame that's going to help us,
Oh, my gosh.
How about that?
Aspartame was the closest thing we saw to Prozac before Prozac hit the market.
So it's another one, huh?
It is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, so.
And what's interesting is on these drugs, you will crave that. I have people that will go through a gallon, 2 gallons of Diet Pop a day when they're on this stuff. It's just amazing. In fact, I had a fellow that was cutting my hair one day, and I was telling him what I do, and he said, well, I took one of those drugs for a while, and it didn't have any adverse effect on me. And I said, oh, really? And so I said, that's probably because you don't know what adverse effects these drugs produce. And I said, what about your memory? I said, can you remember much of anything anymore. And he said, oh, my memory did get really bad. I mean, these affect the memory so strongly that amnesia is listed as a frequent side effect. If you can't remember who you are, how are you supposed to remember anything else in life?
Yeah, that's right.
If you're directing planes at an airport, how can you remember whether one plane's coming from one direction or the other?
Oh, my God.
It's scary when you really think about how important memory is.
Yeah, of course. And if you think about
all
the...
car together and happen to forget a part.
Yeah. And all the people out there, as you say, potentially that are in these kinds of positions, that are on these drugs. I mean, it's a culture of, excuse the term, but idiots in the end that's going to be left.
Exactly. You have blackouts.
Yeah.
Constantly having blackouts because of the overactivity, which is seizure activity in the brain.
Mm.
And you just black out for a few minutes and you can't remember. People will say that they can't remember how they got from point A to point B because they have these blackouts on the drug. One girl said, I can't remember my first year of college because they had me on Prozac. And, of course, my first thought was, wow, that's a lot of tuition money down the drain. You could tell that she was very upset that it had stolen a year of her life. And it's criminal.
Of course,
of course. It really is to steal that from someone. And often, in fact, I just had a talk with Marie Osmond. Do you know who Marie Osmond is?
No, I don't recognize the name, no.
Popular singer here in America, the Osmond family.
Oh, okay, yeah, I recognize that name, the Osmond family. But is that
right.
The name of the
they
band? Right,
they've been on these drugs for quite some time, and she's just recently filed for divorce from her husband.
Oh, really?
And I've had to explain to him that we know that these drugs can cause you to suddenly fall out of love. Even though you've been very happily married for 40 years, you start on these and suddenly you're no longer in love. Well, I'm convinced that it has a lot to do with the memory. Because I had a cousin who was married to a fellow who was in a car accident. And he drove off into a ditch and was electrocuted when that happened. He hit an electric wire on his way down. And because of that, it wiped out his memory. He survived the shock, but it wiped out his memory of falling in love with her, marrying her, having a child with her. All those memories were completely gone. The only thing he could remember when his memory did start was his ex-wife.
Oh, really?
Now, that was a big problem. It did cause their divorce because he could never remember falling in love with her.
Oh, my.
So if you can't remember, if you no longer have those memories, so many people say they don't know who they are.
Yeah.
They don't know if they can ever be the person that they used to be because they can't even remember who they were.
And then, you know, the because I guess that the root of this, much of it anyway, ties back to the fact that that people are feeling anxious, that they are depressed or some similar, feeling or emotional state, that this is something to be medicated. This is something that we must take away from people. But when you say the things you do there, I mean, when people lose their own identity and even their memory, I mean, there's not much, not much left to even be depressed about. There's no memories there even, you know?
Exactly. And when you're anesthetizing someone, how do you expect them to be depressed? What do you feel under anesthesia?
This is nothing.
I don't remember feeling anything at all under anesthesia.
That's right.
And that's the whole idea. If you're anesthetizing someone, what makes anyone think that's therapeutic?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's nothing therapeutic about knocking someone out and saying, there, you're better. It makes no sense. It's time to take responsibility for our own health. and take care of our bodies and our brains by nourishing them.
Yeah.
Give them what they need in order to function. That's all they ask for.
That's right.
And once you do that, and instead of forcing them with all these different chemicals that we use constantly, and I include sugar and NutraSweet. I mean, if people want something sweet, the most logical thing in the world to use is stevia.
Mm-hmm.
It's an herb. They call it the sweet herb.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an herb that heals the pancreas.
Mm.
And it's 9 times sweeter than sugar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Stevia, I got to look that up.
You know, why? And probably the only reason that people don't use it like crazy and use sugar instead is because the sugar is a bigger business.
Yeah, of course.
It kind of all goes back to big business.
Of course, and what people get hooked on, you know, also, I guess.
Exactly.
You know. So, again, I want to return to that question. You know, is depression something that we should, you know, medicate? I mean, this is part of our culture, it seems.
That's why I said you really need to take care of your health.
Mm.
And it is normal to have depression.
Yeah, exactly.
Not debilitating depression, but it is normal to have depression.
Mm.
Debilitating depression generally comes from not taking care of your health.
Mm.
It usually is related either to a thyroid problem, hormonal problem, or the very most common is a blood sugar problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't take care of that blood sugar problem, you'll end up diabetic. And so many of these patients end up in diabetic shock, insulin shock from these drugs.
Mm.
And that's when some of these really terrible things are happening.
Mm.
I don't think people know enough about blood sugar and how that affects your mental health.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Because remember when I said before, when your blood sugar drops, what does your body do? It kicks in adrenaline to normalize the sugar levels.
Mm-hmm.
Which adrenaline, it's your fight or flight hormone.
Yeah.
So you either become angry or you panic.
Mm.
And they're turning around and giving people drugs for that.
Yeah.
You don't need that. You need to stay away from the sugar that's causing it to begin with. Start getting sugar in the form that God put it on earth. He put it in fiber.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't believe in God, the way nature provides it, it was put in fiber. And the reason why, I mean, when you bite into an apple, you get the sugar, but you get the fiber to slow down the sugar release in the body.
Yeah.
So you don't get a direct sugar hit that shocks the pancreas and makes it produce too much insulin, which drops your sugar lower than ever, and then you've got this vicious cycle going.
Mm. Yeah.
It's very simple to understand.
But
it almost makes you wonder when in America they decided in the 70s that hypoglycemia was not a disease.
Really?
Right at the same time they were developing these drugs that would, from what they could see, I'm sure, would make them a whole lot of money if hypoglycemia remained rampant.
Hmm. Oh, my God. So I want to
think there was a conspiracy there.
Mm-hmm.
It's the way we do business in America.
Well, yeah. Well, of course. I mean, the idea of conspiracy is not, you know, it's something that is a part of our culture. You know, it's part of everything. It's part of business. It's part of, you know, it's not a theory. It's a fact. I mean, so
I know. And it's never made any sense to me at all. I've always said if people would learn to work together, they would all be so wealthy they wouldn't know what to do. But we've never learned that.
So I want to, you know, talk a little bit about you know, obviously at this point, I think people don't need to hear, you know, the obvious thing. You know, if people want to have talked with a doctor or whatever that recommends them to start taking this, the obvious answer here is, of course, no. But I mean, if people are on these drugs, you mentioned a little bit about that it's very dangerous to go straight off of them.
Very dangerous. You usually have to take about half the amount of time you were on the drug to come off.
Mm.
In fact, Eli Lilly changed their policy after they had the patient hang herself in their laboratory. She had been on the new Cymbalta for 20 days, and they took her off of the drug within 4 days, and she hung herself.
So what she should...
So they changed it and said, okay, after 20 days on the drug, we're now going to take 8 days to come off, which
okay.
is just about half the amount of time,
mm-hmm.
which is what I'd been saying for years
mm-hmm.
we had to do.
So... But there is
the safest way to do it.
Okay, so there is a method. It's not like if you're on them, it's you're screwed for life, as it were. There is
a way. No, you can get off. It's just in knowing how to get off.
Mm.
You can come off a little faster than that if you do all kinds of nutrition. But you have to hit nutrition and hit it hard with a really good alternative doctor.
Mm.
But hyperbaric oxygen treatment is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I have a tape or a CD that goes for an hour and a half detailing everything that you need to do that we've found to be the safest way to come down. And patients will take their pills and file them down with a fingernail file.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To take a little bit less and a little bit less, or they'll open their pills and take one bead at a time out or a tiny bit of powder out.
Mm.
And you just sneak away from these drugs is the way to do it.
Oh, I see.
Very slowly and gradually, and I tell patients it's kind of like being on a very tall mountain, a very steep mountain. You don't want to come off of that mountain in one step.
That's right. You don't want to jump.
You want to ease down as gradually as you possibly can, one tiny step at a time.
Mm. Tell us a little bit about your organization there, International Coalition for Drug Awareness, and tell us a little bit about, you know, what you do, because as you say, you've been involved in this for a very long time. What you do to fight this, basically.
Education. We're doing everything we can to educate people as fast as possible. Of course, I took 4.5 years to put my book together. I gathered all the research I could find on serotonin and put it in one text, thinking that doctors would be glad that they had it all together in one book,
mm-hmm.
because most of them don't have 4.5 years to take out of their career just to look at one group of drugs.
That's right.
So we've got that as a resource, and people tell me all the time when they read it, they'll say, oh my gosh, you wrote my life history and you never met me. Well, it's just because that's what the drugs do. And then we've got directors around the world that are doing what they can in their own areas to spread information and get information out about what's happened to them, what's happened to their families, the effects that we know that these drugs have, the research that is out there that you rarely hear about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're also working to set up a center to start really educating reporters and police officers and attorneys and all kinds of other people that need to understand the impact of these drugs on our society. We're gathering cases. We've been doing that for a long time. The International Coalition for Drug Awareness has been around for about 10 years. before that, we were a smaller group in just the state of Utah.
Mm-hmm.
And went international 10 years ago. So we just have, it's just volunteers, everyday people who've been through these nightmares that want to warn others before it's too late for them.
Yeah.
But we have started posting these cases that we've been gathering. We've got one of our directors just in her spare time putting them up. And in a year, she's already posted 1,800 cases of murder and suicide and school shootings and just about every mass murder you hear about in America is related to these drugs.
You know, I didn't want to just mention that, of course, we don't have time here today to tell the entire story of behind Columbine. I know that you have been involved in this, very much the aftermath, as it were, to this. But one thing I was glad to hear was when I went on your website, drugawareness.org, I heard a small speech, an excerpt from a speech by Michael Moore, and finally,
right.
At least he was addressing this issue, and this must be helpful, you know, from that guy to spread the message about this, I guess.
Yes. Yes, he got a copy of my book when his movie Bowling for Columbine premiered.
Mm.
So that's why in the statement he says, well, in the movie Bowling for Columbine, we looked at all the reasons why society said it happened, and he said none of them made any sense.
That's right.
The only thing that does are these drugs.
Yeah.
It's how you change. That's the only way to drastically change someone's behavior.
Hmm. Yeah.
Other than perhaps a brain tumor.
Yeah. So one thing
does not change that quickly.
Yeah. I see what you mean. One thing I did want to ask you about is since at the time Columbine was the largest school shooting, you know, when I remember I heard a few programs with you, and I think his name was Mark on the Jeff Rentz program.
Mark Taylor,
that's right. And since then, we of course have had the Virginia Tech shooting, which since
right.
then is I guess the largest American school shooting. Do you have any information about this? Do you know if this kid was on any SSRI or something like that?
I've never seen them cover up a case as fast.
Really?
That's all I can say about that one.
Okay, yeah.
I guess they figured there'd been so many and people were starting to really look that they passed a law saying that they could not divulge the toxicology report.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Really? When was this law? Right before this?
Right, same time.
Really? It was? Oh, my God.
How convenient.
Very convenient. Oh, my God.
Now, that did happen at Columbine as well.
Mm-hmm.
See, they
mm-hmm.
got away with it once.
Hmm.
And so they probably figured they could do it again, especially when this one was so big.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Columbine, we quickly found out about Eric Harris.
Mm-hmm.
But I was working with the coroner, and I told them that I wanted copies of the toxicology reports as soon as they got them. Well, they faxed Eric's to me, and I stood there at the fax machine waiting for Dylan's.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it wasn't coming. The fax was finished, and I called them, and I said, well, all I got was Eric's.
Mm.
Where's Dylan's?
Mm.
And I got the strangest comment from the coroner that I've ever heard. She said, well, Dylan was pretty much a weird kid anyway.
Okay.
I thought, what?
Because
I said, you know, you don't have someone shooting their friends unless they're taking something.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get someone to do that. And that's when she said, well, Dylan was pretty much a weird kid anyway.
Mm.
And I thought, coroners don't say things like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Coroners are there to do scientific research.
Yeah, not to.
And his records were sealed immediately.
Mm.
And never have been opened.
Hmm.
And yet we had a friend of his come forth about a year and a half ago, and she met with Mark and his mom and told them that she was trying to help Dylan get off Zoloft and Paxil. And I figured he was on Zoloft because the lead attorneys for Pfizer were right there in Denver. And they were the ones that handled the case for Solvay when Mark filed against them for causing Columbine. There were just too many ties. Welcome to the world of politics.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I can't look at this from every angle I try to look at this. I see a huge, conspiracy everywhere, basically. And this is about, I see it as, this
cover
is about
up.
Altering, yeah, exactly, cover up. And I see it about altering humanity, creating chaos within society, and at the same time turning everybody into a mindless zombie, basically. I mean, are there any statistics at this point on how many people... Worldwide, I guess, is difficult to get, but let's take America then, because that's where you're based. How many people are on, do you know how many people in America are on these drugs today?
It's really difficult to find out. I did just get a report from a couple of people that said that they heard on television that like 48%.
What?
And I
48%?
Thought, no.
Oh, my God.
I think that's wrong, but I did find another. In searching for those articles, I did find one where it said 23%.
Well, still, that's a huge number. I mean, that's millions of people, you know?
Oh, I know.
Oh, my God.
Okay. I know. I know it's scary.
Yeah.
In the beginning, when I was first writing my book, I used to always wear a button that said, just say no to Prozac or just say no to Zoloft.
Mm.
And it was easy to find out who was on what, because it'd just come up and say, well, why would I do that? I'm on it. What's wrong with it? You know, so at least you had some idea of who was taking what, and it was just amazing how many people would come up and say, oh, my husband or my wife or my son or my daughter or somebody is on it. You got to hear what happened to them. I mean, I heard that constantly from people.
Yeah. What about Ritalin? Is that an SSRI also?
Ritalin does have a pretty strong effect upon serotonin. It's more, Ritalin is methylphenidate. It's a methamphetamine. But those drugs do have a serotonergic effect as well. I think they probably have a little bit stronger effect on norepinephrine, which is the adrenaline within the brain. But the antidepressants, most of the antidepressants have an effect upon that as well. So they are pretty similar in a lot of ways. But it is more like speed. But then antidepressants, if it's the opposite of a depressant, it's a what? Stimulant.
Yeah, exactly. Stimulant. Yeah, that's
These
right.
These are all
yeah.
stimulants.
Yeah.
So they're really not that different from Ritalin.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, and listen, I want to, you know, I know that you have a busy schedule today and we have spent about an hour here. So again, I want to thank you so much for taking the time and speaking to us today and helping us to, you know, inform the people who are worried or have questions about this or, you know, want some advice, and also to highlight, you know, your research as you have been into this field for so long now. But before we round things off for today, I want to leave the floor open here for you the last few minutes. I want you to tell us about your website. I also want you to mention your book's name and how it's available, and also your, I think you mentioned that you have an audio CD out there also.
I do. Yeah, that's the one thing that people scream at me about the most, is that I always forget to mention those things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The website is drugawareness.org. drugawarenes.org. And the name of the book is Prozac, Panacea, or Pandora, Our Serotonin Nightmare. So it's about the whole Prozac family of drugs, meaning all of these new antidepressants. And I do have a CD called Help, I Can't Get Off My Antidepressant. As I mentioned, it goes for an hour and a half detailing how to come off of these drugs safely. And you can access the order line worldwide at 800-280-0730, 800-280-0730, or you can order online.
Excellent, and everything is available on drug.
There's too many zeros in that.
Yeah.
800-280-0730.
There we go. Yeah, and drugawareness.org. That's the main website for people who want to order from, you know, another country, I guess, and so forth.
And there's lots of information up there.
Definitely. Yeah. Everybody, do check that out. And again, and thank you so much for taking the time. This has been very informative, and you know, I hope that everything goes well and that we are able to, you know, highlight enough information for people to become aware of this before it's, you know, what, too late, basically, you know. So I want to, you know, thank you so much for all the work that you do, and keep up the good spirit, and keep on fighting, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Let's finish off this program by listening to an excerpt from Adam Curtis, The Trap, and this is a small portion of this three-part documentary that is about SSRIs, and some interesting points in here. So let's listen.
Chagnon's experiment caused a sensation within the human sciences because it seemed to offer precise mathematical proof that genes played a powerful role in guiding human behavior. It became one of the fundamental pieces of evidence underpinning a new, powerful model of human beings. They were machines whose actions and feelings were driven by coded instructions implanted deep inside them millions of years ago, of which they were unaware. It was an image that began to permeate deep into our culture.
The image of the organism, including ourselves, as a machine for passing on genes, to shift the focus away from the idea of the organism as being the agent in life, to the immortal replicator.
Our DNA is a coded description of the worlds in which our ancestors survived.
DNA, it's the computer recipe for life itself, unraveling like a reel of magnetic tape on some giant computer.
Back in the dark and frightening days of the Cold War, mathematicians had developed a simplified, machine-like model of human beings whose behavior could be analyzed and predicted by numbers. They had done this to try and understand and control the terrifying uncertainties of that time. Now in the 1990s, the Cold War was over and its giant defenses lay empty. But that simplified model had risen up and triumphed as an explanation of what we truly are as human beings, on every level, politically, economically, and now biologically.
We no longer see this theory as having historical inspiration in the Cold War. Instead, what we see it as a kind of quasi-natural social science theory of everything. It applies to something as small as a gene, or something as medium-sized as a human being, or something as large as a nation-state. The human being sort of dissolves in this social theory, that it isn't about necessarily human beings anymore. It's about these little entities that are constantly questing to reproduce themselves and also find their maximum advantage.
And with the rise of this machine model of human beings, a new idea of how to change society began to emerge. Not through politics any longer, but by adjusting how well the individual machines functioned. The technicians of this new idea would be the psychiatrists and the drug companies who would free people from the terrible anxieties inside themselves. But what it would lead to would be a new form of order and control, not defined by the old political elites, but by the objective power of numbers.
I just found myself constantly worrying. I just couldn't stop.
My hands were shaking, and I was sure that people were looking at me and watching my hands.
These college students didn't know it then, but they were each experiencing the symptoms of an anxiety disorder. Panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, social phobia, and post-traumatic stress disorder.
This year, 23 million Americans will suffer from one of these anxiety disorders. They're the most common mental illness in the country, and they can attack anyone at any time.
In the early 90s, an epidemic of mental disorder was sweeping America and Britain. As last week's program showed, it had been uncovered by a new system for identifying disorders. Psychiatry had been attacked for relying on the personal and fallible judgment of psychiatrists. And instead, a new objective method based on checklists had been invented. These listed only the objective symptoms and deliberately did not inquire into why individuals felt an anxiety. In the late 80s, nationwide surveys had revealed an incredible picture. More than 50% of Americans suffered from mental disorders.
I don't know, I'm just sad.
But at the very same time, the drug companies had announced that they had created a new type of drug called an SSRI, which they claimed targeted the circuits inside the brain that were causing these malfunctions. The SSRIs were marketed under names like Prozac. What they did was alter the amounts of serotonin that flowed across the circuit connections within the brain, and they readjusted the chemicals to normal levels.
And then all of a sudden, here comes somebody that says, okay, now try these on, try this Prozac on. And I tried it on, and for the first time in my life, I went, whoa, is this the way reality really is?
This pill can solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac, and it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
I've been taking Prozac for 2 years.
And what difference has that made?
Brilliant.
Oh, she's smiling, eyes light up.
And I feel as if I'm back to normal.
You feel normal?
Yeah.
And you feel a better person?
Yeah.
Through treatment, I learned to function with my disorder, and now life is so much more enjoyable.
Life is so much better now that I've gotten treatments. And I feel like I've got my OCD under control, and it feels really great.
A better life is waiting.
What now began to happen was that millions of people who had been diagnosed by the checklist as disordered went to psychiatrists to be medicated. The result was liberation from anxiety on a wide scale. But in the process, the checklist became a powerful and seemingly objective guide for people as to what should be their normal feelings and what was abnormal. And a number of leading psychiatrists began to argue that what they were actually doing was creating a static society in which human beings were adjusted by the medication so they fitted to an agreed normal type defined by the checklist.
People come to me all the time asking me to medicate them. The implication behind that was that human beings, like all other animals, have a particular ideal model. It had a machine-like quality to it. We know what the model should be. And they asked the medications, they asked of me to give them medications that would push them back to this particular model they have, an unrealistic model, but a very static model of man as machine.
Has it worked? You look very dubious, my friend.
Apparently it has. I can't help being suspicious of it. I don't think she's the woman I married.
Why?
I think she's changed.
In what way?
I don't know, but there's something there that is different.
Okay, she's not the woman you married. Is she a better woman?
No, she's different.
They imagined that they might live in a world where there would never be a worry, not even a grief, where never did conflict, concern, worry over alternatives make possible the kinds of progress that we've seen in the past.
But then, the man who had created the checklist system admitted that it might actually be leading millions of people to believe that they were disordered when they were not. The checklists added up only observable symptoms. They deliberately excluded any understanding of the patient's life. Because of this, he said, it confused genuine psychological disorder with normal human feelings of sadness and anxiety, and that this was happening on a wide scale. All this was being said by one of America's most powerful psychiatrists, Dr. Robert Spitzer.
What happened is that we made estimates of prevalence of mental disorders totally descriptively, without considering that many of these conditions might be normal reactions, which are not really disorders. That's the problem, because we were not looking at the context in which those conditions developed.
So you have effectively medicalized much of ordinary human sadness, fear, ordinary experiences. You've medicalized them.
I think we have, to some extent. How serious a problem it is not known. I don't know if it's 20%, 30%, I don't know. But that's a considerable amount if it is 20 or 30%.
What was happening was that large parts of normal human experience, grief, disappointment, loneliness, were all being reclassified as medical disorders. In the process, a new system of management was emerging. The drugs took away those complex and difficult feelings and made the individuals happier. But they also made them simpler beings, more easy to predict and manage, and closer to the machine-like creatures at the heart of the economic models.
By using checklists of symptoms about emotions, you have gone out and confused normal human responses to life with mental disorder, and therefore created an illusion of a vast epidemic, a medicalized illusion. And obviously a situation where you medicalize is a situation where your focus will not be on social change, it will be on controlling individuals to fit in properly. That's the subtle and overall danger here, that it could serve our kind of social economic systems needs in a way in which we become more efficient, but less human.
For you subscribers, I suggest you pop on over to the subscriber section in our radio archive and tune in to myself and Fredrik talking about the recent news about former MI5 agent and 9/11 truther David Shaler. We're going to listen to a few clips and jive about everything from David's claim that he's the new Messiah and that he was King Arthur in a previous life. We're going to talk about some 9/11 theories and speculate about some of the similarities between David Shaler and David Icke. Some weird stuff is going on here. Mind control or spiritual awakening? Tune in. If you're not subscribing and want to have full access to our radio archive, all information on how you can subscribe is available on our website, redicecreations.com. Just click on radio or subscribe from our front page, and from there you'll find all the necessary information. Thanks to Fredrik behind the controls, and thank you for tuning in to the program. We will be back on Thursday with another program for you. Until then, relax and enjoy all the weirdness of this world. This is Henrik Palmgren. Take good care, friends. We'll talk later.